This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Dr. Gary Stewart. Dr. Stewart is assistant professor of history at Colorado Christian University, and he's authored a brand new book released in 2021 with Oxford University Press titled Justifying Revolution, the American Clergy's Argument for Political Resistance, 1750 to 1776. Dr. Stewart, congratulations on the new book, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Zach. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, and I'm glad to have gotten the chance to read your book, which I'm sure our listeners will be excited to hear about. But before we discuss the book, can you share with us a little more about yourself, your academic background, that sort of thing?
Yes, I was an undergraduate history major at South Dakota State, and after that spent a number of years pursuing biblical and theological studies and pastoral training. I received an MDiv from the Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and was a pastor for almost 7 years in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. While I was there, I did a master's degree in historical theology from Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. They had a London extension program, so I was able to study in London while living in Newfoundland. And then I came back to the States and received a PhD in church history and historical theology from the Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville. So for the past 6 years, I've been teaching history at Colorado Christian University in Lakewood, Colorado, a Denver suburb. And my focus at the university is on American history. So that's my main area of teaching at the university.
Very good. That's all really interesting. And you know, as we look at some of the books you've published recently, it looks like you've published several in a pretty short amount of time. And this is obviously the latest of those. Can you tell us something of the genesis of this new book, Justifying Revolution? And why did you feel like this book needed to be written?
Yeah. Before I got interested in church history and historical theology, I was very much interested in American politics and American political history. And I think that church historians often focus quite narrowly on church-related things and sometimes don't understand the surrounding political and cultural context very well. And on the flip side, I think a lot of secular historians often don't understand church history or theological history and distinctions very well also. So I've been drawn to areas of study where there's a kind of bridging of the gap between general, broad American history, political and cultural history, and then also church history, and bringing these fields together with my interest in social, political thought as well. So one of my previous books was written on a 19th century figure in church history, J.W. Alexander of Princeton Seminary, and his interaction with American culture and social reform schemes in the antebellum period. I think more work needs to be done on understanding the role of religion in the shaping and development of America's cultural and political life. And I've sought to do areas of research that bring all of my interests together in terms of American history, church history, and social political thought as well. Specifically, this book, Justifying Revolution, was born out of what I believe to be a misunderstanding in the academy of the American clergy's support of the American Revolution. It's been quite common for evangelical church historians to view the American clergy as corrupted by Enlightenment secularism or Lockean political views or something foreign and alien to their tradition. And that's often viewed as the reason for why they supported political resistance to the British. They're obviously walking away from the Bible to support political resistance. So as the argument goes, they supported the revolution, and that signals a rejection of their biblical theological heritage for some sort of mega shift in their thinking for secular or Enlightenment or Lockean notions of liberty and freedom. And that's been the dominant view for some time, seeing the patriot clergy as somehow accommodated or somehow making fundamental alterations, walking away from their biblical theological heritage. And that's been a view that, that I wanted to question and wanted to explore. Personally, I felt the need for myself to wrestle with the question of the morality and legitimacy of the American Revolution. As an American, you know, I'm studying in England and I'm befriending lots of folks from across the pond and receiving some healthy questions and challenges. You know, what was America born on the back of a sinful and ungodly rebellion? You know, how did the spiritual and theological leaders of the nation think through these things? And so it was a combination of a kind of dissatisfaction with how the American clergy were treated by the academy, and also just personally some questions. I'm a very patriotic American and wanted to really explore the morality and ethics and legitimacy of the American Revolution itself. So all of these things kind of fed into the birth of this book.
You know, you say right off the bat in the introduction that the American clergy who had supported the revolution, they've been misunderstood. You mentioned that here and how you've conceived of your task in this book. I'm wondering if you can walk us through some of these specific histories of American clergy and where these accounts seem to err. What methodological approaches are they taking that are leading to these different notions that American clergy sort of had, you know, either synthesized Christian and secular ideas or made particular philosophical shifts? Where are these histories sort of messing up that your book seeks to correct?
Yeah, I'm very humbly entering into a field that has some very impressive scholars, a very impressive scholarship that's been done. But I am pushing against specifically some arguments made by Mark Knoll. Mark Knoll is a widely respected evangelical historian. And in his book, his 2005 book, America's God, he makes this argument quite quite strongly, the Patriot clergy set aside the Bible to in their support of political resistance. He argues they were influenced by something he terms Christian republicanism to do so. And he's held this view and promoted this view for a long time. In way back in 1983, Mark Knoll was joined by George Marsden and Nathan Hatch in their book In Search of Christian America, where they were heavily critical of the Patriot clergy for their apparent accommodations of scripture to Enlightenment exegesis. And that has sort of set a sort of standard interpretive view within the academy. And many other historians have sought to take that interpretation and have applied that to understanding of American religious history in general, viewing the Revolutionary era as a period of major shifts in American religious thought. So others like Greg Fraser and John Wilsey and some others have sort of adopted the Knoll perspective. I think that this perspective it makes two fundamental errors. Knoll, Marsden, Hatch, and others have pretty much uncritically adopted Bernard Balin's neo-Whig perspective on revolution. Balin was a very important historian who really founded a whole school of historians, interpreters of American history. But Balin argued that the supporters of the revolution were motivated by 18th century political radicals, the Commonwealth men. And Knoll and others have directly applied Balin's perspective onto the American clergy. And I think it's a mistake to do that. Whatever merits Balin's argument might have for the broader population, setting those aside, I think it's improper to simply apply those onto the American clergy. I think also the second error that's made is, I think that historians like Knoll have not taken the time to understand the clergy's own theological tradition on the question of political resistance. Protestants from the early 16th century onward had wrestled with the question of political submission, what is the limits or extent of obligation required in scripture. Through the reign of Mary the First in the 1500s, period of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in the 1570s, on into the English Civil War, the Restoration period, onto the Glorious Revolution, Protestant theologians and pastors have wrestled with the question of political resistance, the extent and bounds of political submission for a long period of time. And Knoll and others in their writings completely ignore this tradition, the Reformed political resistance tradition, we could call it. And I feel like if one's going to understand the Patriot clergy properly, one has to understand their own theological background, their own the previous discussions surrounding the ethics of political resistance. It's inappropriate simply just to apply Balin's neo-Whig perspective on the clergy. It's better to understand the clergy's own theological heritage and their own tradition. What was the state of the question on political resistance leading up to the American Revolution? And that's what I've sought to do, to recover that historical context, to properly put the Patriot clergy's arguments within their proper historical context, and thereby understand their arguments sort of on their own terms and from within their own perspective.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And, you know, you engage a wide range of scholarship and histories of political resistance. And within that growing body of literature about Christianity's role in these things in America's founding. And I think your book is a terrific contribution to that dialogue. And, you know, the conclusions that you draw and that you've mentioned about sort of rejecting the idea of major shift in Protestant thought, and the idea of the revolution as purely secular. These and a few other implications you get into in your conclusion. They're really brought out nicely through how you framed, you know, just a really nice chronological structure of the book. So as we begin looking at the book here, you've started around 1750. Who are the players that you're dealing with here in 1750 as we start thinking about the justification of political resistance?
Yeah, 1750 is an important year. It's as I started the narrative, it's important to again assess the state of the question of political resistance before the period of the Troubles in 1760s, 70s of England. So I started with one individual in particular, Jonathan Mayhew. Mayhew was a Congregationalist minister in Massachusetts, and he published a very important sermon on political resistance, provoked by the Jacobite supporters of the deposed Stuart line of James II. So James II had been deposed in the Glorious Revolution, 1688. But the supporters of James and his line didn't go away. There were a number of Stuart uprisings, the heirs of James, claiming their legitimacy to the throne. It was in 1745 that Bonnie Prince Charlie rose up and tried to assert his legitimacy as the lawful and rightful king of England. He was in the line of James, the deposed king. So the supporters of the Stuarts continued to argue that the Glorious Revolution was illegitimate, that political resistance was illegitimate because of their view of the divine right of kings. So the current monarch, the Hanoverian line, the George II, was therefore illegitimate. And from Mayhew, he is confronting those supporters of the Stuarts who were arguing against the Glorious Revolution. And therefore, they were arguing really against the legitimacy of the King of England. So in his day, Mayhew's day, there were British subjects that honored Charles I as a martyr and who claimed to be loyal to the Stuart line. So Mayhew argues that loyalty to the present King of England demands that you believe in the legitimacy of political resistance, because that's what the Glorious Revolution was all about. So to be loyal to the king, you have to agree that political resistance is sometimes justifiable, that the current monarch even rests upon the doctrine of political resistance. So Mayhew makes a very important argument. He is lauded and praised by John Adams as being very influential. Adams says that Mayhew was read by everyone, and Mayhew was very important for promoting the notion of a morally justified expression of political resistance. But Mayhew didn't originate these views. He was very open about that. Mayhew was very open about that he basically got his views from an English bishop, Bishop Benjamin Hoadley, who had made the case against the Jacobite supporters of the Stuarts in the early 1700s. In fact, Mayhew sent a copy of his work to Bishop Hoadley saying, You're owed a copy of it because I basically stole this from you. So Mayhew's doing nothing new, nothing distinctly American, but is carrying forward a long line of arguments raised against Stuart absolutism, which we see in the 1600s and then also in the 1700s as well.
So we have Mayhew providing justification of resistance to this founding generation. Then you have another big signpost for political expression of resistance. And that's what comes along during the Stamp Act crisis in 1765. What was the Stamp Act, and what about it led America to sort of reassert itself in terms of resistance?
Yeah, the Stamp Act was one one piece of British policy coming out of the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, where England had exerted great expense to basically rid the North America of the French. And the Stamp Act was passed for the express purpose of extracting revenue from the British colonists in North America. It inflamed and provoked great resistance in the British colonies, not so much over the issue of money, but because of the political principle that it seemed to violate. The Stamp Act was seen as a violation of fundamental English rights and liberties. It was a part of the English Constitution going back as far as the Magna Carta in 1215, that taxes wouldn't be levied, revenues wouldn't be extracted without the people's representative consent. So the many, not just in the colonies, but many in England as well, viewed the Stamp Act with great foreboding, believing that the old specter of political absolutism was on the rise again, as the position taken by Parliament was one that seemed to transgress traditional limits, traditional restraints and restrictions upon the government. So it was seen as an unconstitutional violation of fundamental British laws, and that raised the fear of political absolutism being on the rise again. You know, the 1600s were dominated by this fight against Stuart absolutism, and now we have in the 1700s an absolutist position taken by the Parliament again. In fact, the very day that the Stamp Act was finally repealed, the very day it was repealed, the British passed what was called the Declaratory Act in 1766, declaring that the King and the Parliament had a right to bind the colonies in all cases whatsoever. A statement of absolutism that echoed what had been applied to the Irish in, I think it was 1719, which subjugated and conquered people. It was a posture, a position of absolutism that was taken. So the stamp, you know, the issue of taxation, that's a surface issue. The bigger issue was the colonists feared political absolutism was on the rise again, and the English Parliament had taken that up as its position against the colonies.
You know, the role of memory, the significance of it, it really can't be understated for how it played into attitudes and beliefs, the actions of historical actors, whatever time period we're looking at. I really appreciated this aspect in your chapter here and how you've connected this mid-1760s resistance to the memory of Governor Andros, who's deposed in 1689. What can you tell us about him and how memory kind of played into those attitudes and beliefs?
Yeah, that was just a really neat discovery I made, that this issue of political resistance was not new in the 1760s and 70s. In the colonies, in the British colonies themselves, there was in fact, a revolution that took place in 1689. In 1689, the tyrannical Stuart-imposed governor of the Dominion of New England, Governor Edmund Andros, was overthrown and deposed. And in 1691, a book was published in Boston, most likely written by a clergyman, published anonymously. And the book was titled The Revolution in New England Justified. They were justifying, they called it a revolution. It's in New England. It's published in Boston. It gives moral justification for why they were morally justified in deposing Governor Andros. They listed the oppressive and absolutist ways that he had governed the New England colonies.
And this same book, The Revolution in New England Justified, was reprinted in Boston in 1773. And so the memory of clergy-led, morally justifiable political resistance was very much a New England tradition that had not been forgotten. You know, it wasn't, you know, that this was a revolution that was not taken on under the influence of John Locke. It's much too early for that. And that the memory of that lingered in many of the sermons in the 1760s, 1770s in New England. Edmund Andros and his tyrannical rule and his being deposed, they put him in jail and sent him back on a ship to England. That his memory was evoked time and time and time again as providing a kind of precedent, a kind of a framework for understanding justified political resistance to oppressive absolutist governments. You don't have to look outside of New England or even outside of, you know, the clergy's own traditions in New England for precedent. And it was just wonderful to discover that this, you know, this volume was reprinted in Boston in 1773 as things are heating up in Massachusetts.
So we have the memory of the past sort of fueling resistance, but also there were some apprehension, some fears about the future here on the eve of the revolution. You talk about that some. Can you share a little bit about what you get into kind of on the eve of the revolution? What are the fears on the horizon?
Yeah. Again, the main fear was that the old enemy of absolutism was on the rise again. Political absolutism. This had been what had led into a civil war against Charles I, whom they subsequently beheaded. It led to the Glorious Revolution. So there's great fear that political absolutism was on the rise again in England. But there was also great concern for religious absolutism in the form of a rising Roman Catholicism. So there was great concern when the British Parliament passed in 1774 the Quebec Act. The Quebec Act essentially expanded the bounds of where Roman Catholicism would be accepted, extending the bounds down into the Ohio Territory, on into the American interior. And this was of great concern that a British Parliament had essentially established Roman Catholicism in the American interior. This greatly concerned many of the Protestant colonists. Again, at this time, Roman Catholicism was very much viewed as a system of oppression and religious absolutism. There was also great concern about plans to impose Episcopal bishops on the colonies. There were plans afoot to perhaps impose Episcopal bishops, and that, of course, made dissenters especially quite concerned about the loss of their religious liberties. So it was sort of a perfect storm of events. The common denominator was absolutism, be it political or religious. The colonists believed that the old specter of absolutism was on the rise again, and it had to be met with godly resistance. That was part of the milieu of what was going on. I think historians err when they seem to make it merely an issue of taxation, an issue of money, or an issue of some abstract political concept. It was the long battle against absolutism that Protestants saw as a kind of beast, equating ecclesiastical absolutism, seeing it in league with political absolutism, and viewing this as something that the godly must resist. So those are some of the trying to recreate, you know, my reading of the sermons, trying to recreate the concerns and fears and attitudes of the time, and this is the central idea that really stands out to me.
Well, Dr. Stewart, if we look further into the 70s, ideas about resistance are now developing, momentum perhaps growing. What was the pushback like? Did clergy specifically, did they suffer any during this time? And then second, were they willing to amend or advance particular arguments that they're making as a result of any suffering that there might be?
Yeah, I think individual clergy suffered variously, be they Tory or Whig, depending on if they were in sync with their communities, local communities or not. But the main issue of suffering that really gripped the colonists was the sufferings endured by Boston after the Boston Port Act shut down Boston Harbor, potentially subjugating the whole urban population there to potential starvation. That produced a great outcry. Later on, King George III would close all the ports, essentially declare colonies closed for trade. So that bit of suffering, along with the reported atrocities enacted on the civilian population of Massachusetts after the British defeat of Lexington and Concord. There were affidavits taken, testimonies of enraged soldiers on their flight back to Boston, committing serious atrocities against the civilian population. And then finally, and very dramatically, the burning of three coastal cities with incendiary shot. There are three cities in particular: Charleston, Massachusetts, just off of Boston, just off of Bunker Hill; Falmouth, Maine; and Norfolk, Virginia, were all burned to the ground in acts of retaliation, revenge, and spite as the British Navy fired incendiary shot into these civilian populations. The effect of all of these acts caused the clergy to begin making arguments for armed resistance on the basis of self-defense. You can see that in their sermons, in their publications, starting in the 1774, 1775 for sure, and 1776 on the verge of declaring independence. The issue for the clergy, the immediate proximate reason for political resistance, became one of self-defense, as these urban populations have been burned and civilian populations have been subjected to catastrophic loss of property and their homes and ability to provide for themselves. So that became there is a shift that takes place as the aggressions of the British are ratcheting up. The arguments do shift to be. More and more arguments are raised in terms of self-defense.
You know, I think this is a good example of how your book flows really well, because you move from British attempts at coercing submission and then into a more detailed discussion of the arguments that British clergy were making with regard to American resistance. So as we think about British clergy, their perspective, was there anything there in your research on the British clergy that perhaps surprised you as you're surveying their opinions?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, to understand the American clergy properly in their context, I thought it'd be important to understand what the British clergy are doing. And I was surprised by how many British clergymen were against the parliamentary policies as it related to the American colonies, and how many British clergymen supported American political resistance, supported even in writing. The majority of the dissenting clergy seem to have supported the American patriots in their resistance, clergymen like Caleb Evans and Thomas Bradbury. John Wesley did not, but his views as a Tory were not representative of a large number of evangelical clergymen. George Whitefield, even though he died before the American Revolution, during the Stamp Act period in the 1760s, makes a number of comments where he clearly indicates that he would be in support of resistance to the absolutist plots that were then afoot. So I think the one thing that surprised me was I came more to understand the American Revolution as a kind of British Civil War. There are a number of members in the British Parliament who supported the American resistance, Edmund Burke, Isaac Barre, William Pitt, and others. I was also surprised to discover a Church of England bishop in his support of American resistance to the Massachusetts Government Act, the act, one of the coercive acts that annulled the Massachusetts Charter. In 1774, he published a short work, a speech on the bill for altering the Charter of Massachusetts. And this was the most widely published political tract in America before Thomas Paine's Common Sense, 1776. So I was surprised to find just a wide variety of British clergymen who were protesting the actions of the British Parliament and the British King toward the colonies. And that helped me understand the American clergy in their context, that they're not doing anything that's unique or new or even distinctly American in their arguments. They're if mega shifts come in their thinking, they come after the revolution, but are not reasons for their support of resistance leading up to it.
It's really good. Well, in your final chapter, you come to a man, John Witherspoon, and he's one that offers some really interesting insight, I think, especially to the question of how to defend the 1776 independence. Thomas Paine's Common Sense that you mentioned, it was a work that seemed to shift colonial perspective on the matter. But in terms of the political philosophy that was underlying it, how likely were the clergymen, Witherspoon especially, how likely were they to take on these types of arguments that Paine was making? Were they making different ones?
Yeah, John Witherspoon is such a fascinating person, a clergyman, the president of the College of New Jersey, a Scottish Presbyterian who emigrated to America from Scotland. Witherspoon had actually apparently been involved in resisting the Bonnie Prince Charlie uprising in 1745. He comes over to America and becomes an early supporter of independence, but not because he adopted Thomas Paine's perspective. In fact, when Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, it was first published anonymously. And Witherspoon critiqued the book heavily when it came out because it was built, it seemed to be a fundamental denial of original sin. There was a denial of just an orthodox view of man. Paine was very much influenced by a more secular enlightenment elevation of mankind. Witherspoon, didn't know immediately who the author was, but basically called him, ignorant of human nature and an enemy of the Christian faith, and was not at all interested in Paine's arguments. He also didn't follow Paine's anti-monarchical republicanism either. Witherspoon held up the British form of government as a good model, a mixed government, elements of monarchy, elements of aristocracy and democracy. We know that Paine would go on to support the French Revolution. Witherspoon was not at all on the same page as Thomas Paine. I think Paine becomes a key figure for those who want to see the American Revolution as born of the same ideology as the French Revolution. But certainly not for the clergymen, not for clergymen like Witherspoon. Witherspoon was operating from a more a British context of resistance, not one of Enlightenment anti-monarchical republican notions. That doesn't fit for Witherspoon, and I don't think it fits for the bulk of the American clergy. So Paine is a really interesting figure, but I think he's more of an anomaly than he is the norm, especially when it comes to assessing the views of the clergy.
Great. Well, Dr. Stewart, I think you make your case well to show really that it would be quite uncharacteristic of biblically minded clergy to then kind of be uncritical and embracing unbiblical views about resistance. And what you suggest, you know, as a better reading, as you say, you know, to present their views on political resistance as they understood them, I think that's a much better route and one that you articulate well. Well, that's probably a good place for us to wrap up here. But before we do that, Dr. Stewart, can you tell us what you're writing on now? What our listeners might expect from you in the future?
I have one small project in the works on a 19th century American Presbyterian leader named Charles Hodge. A small work looking at some of his views on the church and sacraments. But after that, I'm not really sure. I continue to really enjoy topics where there is this intersection of broader political and cultural history and church history. And I want to keep working along those lines in whatever form it takes. So we'll have to see.
Great. Well, that sounds like a good plan, and we'll keep an eye out for what comes next from you. We'd love to have you back on the podcast at some point. But for now, thank you for writing this book. Justifying Revolution is published with Oxford University Press in 2021. And Dr. Stewart, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.